I have another case that involves the same parties. This is case number 55433, Petro versus Groth. Again, it's Ms. Murch for the appellant, Mr. Robinson for the respondent. And I'll reserve thanking counsel until the end of this case. And I'll thank you for both cases on behalf of the panel. So, Ms. Murch, if you would go ahead for the appellant, Ms. Petro.
Okay, the second.
Again, let me just say that Justice Pickering has recused herself from this case. And the Chief Justice, Nancy Sata, sitting in the place.
Okay, while the other case that we just argued, I was not involved in the lower court. I'm just the appellate counsel. This I was directly involved in, and I know. This is about the temporary restraining order that they contend is valid and the preliminary injunction, which is void on its face. It says this preliminary injunction shall issue until a preliminary injunction is issued.
Who prepared the preliminary injunction order, Ms. Murch?
Honestly, I don't know. I could tell you what I think, but I don't know. But even as Mr. Robinson mentioned in his brief, that's just a clerical error. It's an oversight. We all know what it means. But under law, he could have had it amended. He could have moved to it. He could have up here all the way up to this part. There's an error. Let's do a motion to get it corrected. He never did. That's void on its face. But even before we get there, before they get in the doors to get a TRO and then a preliminary injunction, they have to have jurisdiction. And that's under the Mack case and also under Smith versus Emery. That particular issue was the campus ban that President Glick had issued at the time, and this was the first claim in the second case that was filed after her termination. The first claim is a First Amendment claim that is not just protective speech, it protects her conduct and her right to associate and petition. That was part of this appeal that we just argued at this court. It was one of the issues there. In the argument on the TRO, which was just basically slammed on me when I was away and I didn't have my records in front of me, I didn't raise the jurisdiction issue because I wasn't aware at that time. I didn't have my files to again look at the 08 case and see, wait a minute, this first claim is on appeal. It's Glick's ban. There's no jurisdiction. If they wanted to get a TRO, they had two things. They could have come to this court that did have the jurisdiction, or they could have done a Honeycutt motion to have this court give limited jurisdiction back to the district court. They did neither. And in getting the TRO, Mr. Robinson goes in there and he supports it on the very same evidence that they got summary judgment on. He argues res judicata. We got it here. We've got that order from the whistleblower. Res judicata, res judicata. But then when I bring up the jurisdiction at the preliminary injunction, oh, suddenly it's a collateral issue that's not with the court. So which one is it? It's very important in determining whether or not this court has jurisdiction. At the TRO, at the motion for the preliminary injunction, I raised that issue adamantly before Judge Flanagan. Mr. Robinson responded, the only thing that's on appeal to the Supreme Court is the defamation claim. The defamation claim. They went over and over that. I had the copy of the complaint there. We presented it to the court. First claim is for the First Amendment. And then if you look at the evidence upon which this is based, it's identical to what was in the other case that was before the court. The Diedrich Taylor thing, the other affidavits, and so forth. In fact, after the fact, after when around the time they're getting Glick did his letter, the athletic department was soliciting student athletes, Ms. Patro's former athletes. They solicited them to give false affidavits saying, we need to get her banned from campus. Let's do you give us a false affidavit to give us evidence of that. That's in the record, that affidavit of a student athlete. So they were looking for reasons to ban her, but then when it got to the court stage, the TRO, as I said, there was no jurisdiction. Assuming there was, and at the time the judge determined, we have jurisdiction, I said, you don't, let's stay this, let me do a writ to the Supreme Court, let them decide that, and then if it's your ball game, fine. He denied that. He denied my motion to continue it when Mr. Robinson hadn't given any notice whatsoever. He had, I don't know, more than six witnesses all lined up, and he hands me a brief at my table that's like this long. No time for me to prepare. But then even if you get past all that to the TRO, or here we're at a preliminary injunction stage, besides being void on its face, if you look at it, it is so broad. How is Ms. Paltrow supposed to know if something is sponsored by Nevada? She can't go to a baseball game if it's sponsored by Nevada, meaning like a Reno Aces game. You know, obviously the college sports would be included. She doesn't know if she's out at a Starbucks talking to someone and someone else comes and greets her, oh, is this a UNR employee? She doesn't know. This is too broad. It's an unconstitutional restraint, prior restraint on her speech, and it should never have happened. It was based on evidence or allegations that went back as long as 9 years, that there was no clear and present danger. They report to where she wrote a letter to the regents saying she wanted to discuss something. If she didn't get a response, she was going to go to the campus and talk to them. She never did go to the campus. In the TRO record, you can see that the respondents acknowledge that Ms. Paltrow has never, and to this day, she has never violated President Glick's ban. And even though we believe the TRO order is illegal, as far as also the preliminary injunction, she still has the respect, even though she doesn't agree with it, and she has not violated anything. And to have a preliminary injunction that is this broad, I just think is a travesty. That it you cannot do that to someone and restrict their actions in their speech in that matter. Thank you.
Robinson.
Thank you, Your Honors. Again, Kent Robinson for all respondents on the on this appeal. I want to step back and put the need for a TRO in context. We went through all the discovery. We argued the motions for summary judgment in April of 2007. The trial court came out with its first order granting all summary judgment on May 5th. A second, more explicit order granting all summary judgment motions against all claims was May 18th. On May 28th, a notice of appeal was filed. We moved for attorney's fees based upon the offer of judgment. Judge Flanagan awarded us fees. Now, back in 2007, after the termination, the day after the termination, this plaintiff was found in a dark room in the compliance officer's section of the athletic department. Compliance is a very unique situation at the university. It is the intelligence. It is the self-regulating aspect of athletics. It is the one, it is the office, the department, that checks up on coaches and checks up on students to make sure there's no violations. The day after she's terminated, she's sitting in a dark room in the compliance officer's office. Jean Perry found her, made a report. Highly unusual and frightening. After she's terminated, she has a meeting with the athletic director and she says, I'm going to own you. I'm going to go public. I'm going to go humiliate you. I'm going to embarrass you. That's September of 2007. In November of 2007, she goes to a fundraiser called PACPAWS for youth soccer programs in the Reno area. And she confronts one of the athletics now that's conducting the on-campus function. I'm going to get Carrie Groth. She's a liar. I'm going to get her. And it scared this particular individual, and she reported because the plaintiff was very vocal and very confrontational. On December 16th, there's a basketball game at the University of Nevada. And the assistant coach, Antoinette Marjanovic, had been elevated to head soccer coach to replace the plaintiff. This plaintiff went to that basketball game and went up and confronted Graham Abel and the newly appointed soccer coach. And it was confrontational and it was physical.
She was the interim soccer coach.
Yes, sir. Okay. The interim soccer coach while the search was going on. That interim soccer coach was frightened, was instructed to make a police report, and a police report was made concerning the assault by this plaintiff on that particular individual. After that, we have a series of hearings in the administrative hearing where she filed in the administrative letter for reinstatement. She confronted witnesses and she intimidated them. She cornered Cindy Fox in a restroom and grabbed her hand and said, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" She stood in the doorway where Carrie Groth was walking back in the hearing room and said, "What are you, Cindy Fox's bodyguard?"
Mr. Robson, just for, is Cindy Fox related to Coach Fox?
Wife.
Okay.
Was an associate executive athletic director, employed by the university until the Foxes left for Georgia for their new position. But in any event, there was an element of intimidation by this plaintiff at those administrative hearings. It got worse because after that, this plaintiff confronted Cindy Fox at the daycare facility where Cindy Fox had her children attend. And she intimidated Cindy Fox at that particular situation and asked to visit with Olivia, the 9-year-old daughter of the Foxes, and said to Olivia, "Is your mommy saying mean things about me, evil things about me?" And Cindy Fox was frightened. She was very frightened. Because shortly before that, Cindy Fox walked into the parking lot and the window on her car was smashed and her purse was on the seat untouched. And Cindy Fox became increasingly frightened because this plaintiff said to Cindy Fox, "I watch you at the basketball games and I know where you seat. I know where you're seated." She says to Carrie Groth after that, "Carrie Groth, I know where you live and I know what kind of car you drive." She's seen in the bushes by Clark administration, peering through bushes while Cindy Fox and Carrie Groth walk into the Clark administration building. They go over and they confront her. They said, "What are you looking at? What are you doing?" She goes, "Oh, this is where I run from every day." They'd never seen her there before. This is consistent with the kind of stalking activity that the plaintiff engaged in with Dedrick Taylor. But it gets worse. Because after the Kuchenmeister hearing officer, William Kuchenmeister, rendered his opinion against the plaintiff and denied her administrative claim, Ms. Papdahl went public to the paper and said that Mr. Kuchenmeister had conducted a three-ring circus and he's setting the state of Nevada up for another Judge Weller, Darren Mack situation. That's the temperament of this plaintiff. The ban was issued in November 2007. It said, "Ms. Patra, you've accosted the interim soccer coach. Please stay off this campus." Actually, under the code, what the president does, at the advice of Adam Garcia, the chief of the UNR Police Department, President Gleick said, "I withdraw my consent for you to be on the campus to protect the safety and welfare of those staff, faculty, administrators, students on the campus." Now they say that that's on appeal. You look at the appeal on what we call the 08 case, number 826, they never challenge the validity of the ban. You know why? They can't. The ban was the basis for the claim for damage. If they went in and said, "Judge Flanagan, we want a restraining order to prevent the school from enforcing that ban," it would have shot their damage claim in the foot. So they didn't challenge the validity of the ban. So the ban's in place throughout the litigation without a challenge. Yes, there's a First Amendment claim saying that the ban prohibits free speech and there's a damage claim associated with that. But they don't challenge the validity of the ban or the effectiveness of it. And yes, there's a defamation claim saying that the ban inferentially defamed her for damages. And we briefed that. But it wasn't, the validity and the enforceability of the ban was not briefed. So after we won our motion for summary judgment, and she's not been on the campus except for a couple isolated instances where we permitted it, where she's purportedly helping her attorney in another matter, we get into the summer of 2007. She authors three letters to my clients to to President Glick and says, here's a bunch of points and authorities, and you're a bad man, and you've done a bad thing by banning me from the campus, and I'm going to violate your ban. And she writes a letter to the chancellor, Dan Klage, and she says, you better get a handle on these subordinates of yours, like President Glick, because he issued this ban, and in August of 2009, I am going to violate it. My clients gave me those letters, and I said, we've got to get a restraining order. We are not going to deprive the Nevada Supreme Court of deciding the First Amendment damage claim on the ban. We're not going to interfere with the Nevada Supreme Court's decision of defamation for damages on the ban. But we're going to point out to Judge Flanagan that this plaintiff is a clear and present danger to Cindy Fox, to Kerry Grof, to the administrators at UNR, to the children of the Foxes. And we went in and we got a TRO on September 9th, 2009. We gave notice. We gave notice of our intent to appear and present evidence. And the plaintiff filed a brief in opposition to our motion for TRO. Judge Flanagan heard it, and he said, yes, irreparable injury. And he granted our TRO. It was only good for 15 days. So what did the plaintiff do? The plaintiff stipulated to leave that restraining order in full force and effect until February 10th, 2010. She stipulated that it stay in place. And then we presented our evidence on the injunction. It was compelling, and it should remain in full force and effect because it is not a collateral matter, and there's no reason to do a honeycut procedure because we are not asking to alter, modify, or amend any judgment. And that's what honeycut requires. We want the judgment on summary judgment to stay in effect, and we'd like the injunction upheld.
What about the language of the preliminary injunction itself? You have the order granting the preliminary injunction, then the preliminary injunction where it says it remains in effect until the issuance of preliminary injunction. Does that mean that there is a preliminary injunction?
Absolutely.
It sounds like it's TRO language. It was inadvertently put into the preliminary injunction language. What does that legally, how does that legally play out then?
The preliminary injunction incorporates the language of the order granting injunction. The order granting injunctions covers all of that. It is a typographical error. It should have said, until a permanent injunction is issued. They got the message, and they have got the message because they briefed the invalidity of the TRO based upon other matters, which is collateral and jurisdictional. I don't think the typographical error makes it void, and we've cited a couple decisions that are very close to this one in our briefs, Your Honor, that says that this is a typographical error and it should not vitiate.
Now, who prepared, did Judge Flanagan prepare the preliminary injunction?
In part. We prepared, it was, I think, a Friday afternoon. Judge Flanagan says, get that order in here right now. We did. We got it to him about 6 o'clock. It came out later that evening, slightly different. I think that's my mistake. I will be candid with the court. I think that's my mistake, not Judge Flanagan.
Because the order granting was entered at 5:04 p.m. on February 8, 2010. The preliminary injunction was entered 5:02. So about the same time.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Murch, rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to respond first to some things I, again, have heard for the first time here. I've never heard the story of Ms. Patro hiding in the dark in the compliance officer's room. That's never been raised before. Or that she's hiding in the bushes, peering out. That's never been raised before. The issues that or the incidents that have been raised are the Dedrick Taylor issue, which I discussed a little bit in my other argument. He was a basketball coach who recanted in an affidavit. He was solicited by Ms. Groth to write a complaint against Ms. Patro, which he later recanted. He never used the word stalking. The only time the word stalking, you can find it in the underlying thing, is in when Ms. Patrow went for an interview with the police, and she was saying, what does he think, I'm stalking him? This is the first I've ever heard that there was extortion to get him to recant that. That's nowhere in the record. The threats that it's going to make her a millionaire and she owns you, they're taking that, what they're saying is a threat, is when Ms. Groth testified it as to one of the many reasons why she was fired, why Patrow was fired, was because of these threats, including the threats of the inequities in the use of the facilities. The so-called threat wasn't going to make Ms. Patrow personally millions of dollars. She was saying this exposes UNR Nevada to extreme liability, this inequity. This is the threats on which they're getting the TRO. It exposes Nevada to liability because, as we all know, there's many colleges, if it's not fair between the men and the women, they either get rid of some of the men's programs or they have to go build all new facilities for the women. That's where the millions of dollars come in, not to Ms. Patrow's own pocket. This was a Mac Weber situation that she threatened that. I've never heard that before either. The Chancellor letter, that's their clear and present danger. Again, they're basing the TRO on all this conduct that they just went through that was post-termination, Diedrich Taylor, Antoinette Markovich, which, by the way, that has two conflicting incident reports of these two people that were supposedly with her when this person was supposedly accosted. One has them going into the arena with her arm around her. One has them going out, and she's choking her or whatever. That's a fact that shouldn't go into the TRO. What Mr. Robinson has absolutely ignored is what really taints and shows his motivation in this TRO. Yes, he filed it. Yes, I responded to it. I got it, I believe, after 5 o'clock. I was in Los Angeles. I stayed up all night working on it, and I appeared telephonically. So if that's adequate notice, and then, as I said, I'm served the morning of it for the preliminary injunction. That's different than the TRO. Mr. Robinson has a personal agenda on this. Ms. Patrow, at the same time, concurrent, when he's moving to get the TRO and have it so she cannot associate with anyone from Nevada, there is a hearing going on to see if his fraudulent and criminal conduct should go to a grand jury. It's happening at the same time.
Whose conduct?
Mr. Robinson's, Ms. Groth, the players in this case. Ms. Patrow, I'm not counsel that, and some other UNR employees, and this is part of a separate writ that's not part of this to the Supreme Court. At the same time, this is going on in Judge Steinheimer's courtroom.
So this is outside the record that's presently before us?
No. I believe it's in the brief, because at the time, I know I saw it reviewing the brief, at the time when Mr. Robinson served Ms. Patrow with the TRO, she was in Judge Steinheimer's courtroom. He served her in the courtroom, and Judge Steinheimer took a break to reprimand him for that. So he has his own personal agenda. He'll say whatever he can to get him out of that hot water, and that is briefed before this court. The personal motivation was brought up in the hearings before Judge Flanagan.
Is it an accurate statement that Mr. Robinson made that you stipulated to the at least an extension of the TRO to a time certain?
Actually, that's accurate, but let me explain it. He puts it a little bit out of context. The TRO was to expire within 14 days. His calendar, my calendar, he called me, said, hey, I got this going on, that going on. Do you mind if we extend it? That's okay. I've got other things. It was for our own conflicting calendars. And as I said, Ms. Patrow was not doing anything. She never was doing anything to support this TRO. So did it make a difference if it was put out a while? Sure, it for the automatic expiration of a TRO, it would. But because there wasn't anything going on there, it didn't hurt anybody. There was no prejudice to her. She wasn't violating it. But then it goes to the preliminary injunction hearing. So him saying that I wanted to put it out and I put it out, that has somehow, that I'm agreeing that this is a valid TRO, absolutely not. The stipulations were based on other reasons rather than the validity of the TRO. So that is a false argument. And also, I know that there was a writ that was put to the Supreme Court during that time that was denied because they felt it was moot because the 14 days had passed where the TRO would have expired. So they just sent it back saying it's moot, it should be expired. This court didn't know that, yes, we had extended it some. But in that writ, the response, it said, you know, raised its own eyebrow. And all this conduct, this alleged conduct, which is absolutely false, but the Cindy Fox's daughter and stalking and hiding in the bushes and Antoine Markovich and all those things, that is the First Amendment claim in the 08 case. That's the violation of her First Amendment rights. The defamation claim, Mr. Robison focuses on that because that's where it asks for damages, and he can't acknowledge that there is this First Amendment claim. It's the first claim. They just, him and the lower court, Judge Flanagan, just ignored that, moved on to the next claim, and said it's not at the court above. It was, and there was no jurisdiction for Judge Flanagan to act. And the first cause of action clearly in the complaint and in the record below is in regard to the campus ban.
Let me ask you this, Ms. Mersch, on the summary judgment standard, Justice Ada pointed out previously, you cited the case of Wood versus Safeway in your brief, I guess for the proposition of de novo review on that. But Wood versus Safeway kind of somewhat changed the procedures on summary judgments, where it made it very clear that you can't just raise issues of fact. You have to raise legally material issues of fact and all like that. So you feel that these arguments meet the Wood versus Safeway standard?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is evidence. And I really have to defer to our briefs because I think they are very specific. They cite very specifically to the record. Just some examples here. I talked about a declaration they tried to solicit from a student athlete. At 1096 is the declaration of the student athlete that says they're trying to solicit this to get a trespass order. The letter, well, that was part of the other one. There's On both the TRO and the other case, which I'm not going to re-argue, there is absolutely overwhelming evidence that at least brings this to genuine issues of material fact under the new standard, which requires a reversal and remand. And I've discussed the Title IX and both the Section 1983 First Amendment claim in the earlier case and the TRO here. There are a number of other cause of actions brought that I'll have to defer to the briefs because there's just not enough time to argue each and every one of them. There was a substantial amount of credible, admissible evidence submitted in opposition to the summary judgment, which I believe Ms. Patro did not even have the burden to do, and their evidence, as I argued before, was not admissible for the reasons I've mentioned and are in the brief, and absolutely Ms. Patro overcame her burden in a summary judgment motion, and there are significant, genuine issues of material fact, even under the new standard of what she has to overcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Robinson?
Yes, Chair, is there any way to have 1 minute to address the screen? Please?
I'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Ms. Mersch, I'll let you respond. 1 minute, each of you.
Ms. Patra and two other citizens filed an application for a district court to authorize a grand jury investigation of the Nevada Highway Patrol, Nevada Attorney General's Office, the Washoe County District Attorney's Office, the Reno Gazette Journal, the firm of McDonald Corona Wilson, my firm, the University of Nevada Athletic Department, the Nevada Administration, and many, many others. Evidence was taken for 3 days, or I think it was 3 days in that particular hearing. Judge Steiner issued an order completely exonerating me and my firm. It is now subject of a writ that has been filed by the plaintiff.
Ms. Mersch, did you want to respond? Give you a minute.
I'll take my 1 minute. Mm-hmm. This complete exoneration is nowhere in the record. This is probably part of the sealed part of the record that is subject to a writ at the Supreme Court. As I said, I'm not a party to that, but Whether or not they're completely exonerated, I don't know. But Mr. Robison, as I said, went into the TRO hearing, and it was done with Ms. Patrow, Mr. Schweikert, Mr. Groh. These are all UNR-related people. He did it so he couldn't even talk to her co-movements. And so I think that shows his motivation, which overrides the whole motivation of Nevada in this case, which is to discredit my client, make her look like a nut, and just smear her in the newspapers. But she's a strong lady, and she's here, and she's fighting for justice and to get her day in court that she greatly deserves. Thank you.
Ms. Murch. Ms. Robison, Ms. Murch, thank you for your spirited argument. Ms. Matter, this case will stand submitted. We'll be in recess till 11:30.